Next up, I speak with Columbia law professor and human rights lawyer Scott Horton on the PHR report, U.S. obligation to investigate and prosecute American violators of human rights, and the legality of the CIA drone strike program in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Mr. Horton is also the author of the No Comment blog at the Harper's website. So we're here with attorney Scott Horton. We're talking about the PHR report. Scott, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm happy to be with you.
Have you had a chance to read the PHR report?
Yes, I have.
And what stands out on first impression about this report? What is the most important thing we need to understand about this report?
Well, I think about 80% of it is stuff we knew before, but it's rearranging things in an order that makes perfect sense. And it's making the case, and I think a very persuasive case, that the CIA was engaged in human experimentation on prisoners held in the War on Terror. And this experimentation was keyed specifically to what the Bush-Cheney administration refers to as its enhanced interrogation technique program. So the experimentation is geared to testing the ability of these prisoners to cope with sleep deprivation and testing their ability to deal with pain that results from some of these techniques, like long-time standing, hypothermia, waterboarding, and so forth. Which is shocking, of course, because not only is human experimentation of just exactly this sort criminal. It's criminalized in the United States in legislation that was sponsored first in the Reagan administration. It's also criminal under international law. And indeed, the initiative to make it criminal was an initiative commenced by the United States. We took the position that human experimentation that had been undertaken by the Germans and by the Japanese during World War II was a crime against humanity and was a war crime. And in fact, we prosecuted a significant number of doctors, both in the Nuremberg tribunals and in the Tokyo tribunals at the end of the war. I think the other thing that's really shocking here is that the decision to resort to human experimentation seems to have come as a result of a recommendation of the Department of Justice. So our Department of Justice, and specifically we're talking about John Yoo and Jay Bybee, were counseling people in the intelligence community to engage in criminal conduct. Now, that itself is a serious crime under the law, because an attorney is not permitted to advise a client to commit a crime, and yet that's exactly what appears to have happened here. And, of course, the internal Department of Justice study of their memos that was issued earlier this year doesn't in any way deal with this issue or even recognize it. It just breezes right past, which shows that even today the Department of Justice is totally insensitive to these questions about human experimentation.
What is their concept of good faith? That's what we're talking about, is that they, that you and crew had facilitated language that was used to protect the agents by this concept of acting in good faith. How does having a doctor on site taking this information and feeding back to headquarters amount to good faith?
Well, that's right. Let me just start with the legal premise. The legal premise was that that even if the objectively speaking, the practices that were used amounted to torture, nevertheless, if the CIA interrogators and officers believed in good faith that it wasn't torture, they would have a valid defense against a criminal charge of torture. Now, let's just start with the point that that analysis of the law is wrong, because there is no good faith defense against a charge of torture, because torture is defined as a crime against humanity, so the good faith defense doesn't exist. So they start with completely misunderstanding the law. But then the next step is they say that in order to build this defense of good faith, medical professionals should be involved in the process of these interrogation sessions. Best would be to have the medical professionals physically present in the room, have them observe what's going on, have them recording data, and have them give assurance to the interrogators that they haven't crossed the line into technical torture, because this is the sort of pain that the people can bear, and it won't have lasting physical consequences, as John Yoo saw it. You know, he thought that that conduct would only classify legally as torture if it resulted in the failure of a critical organ or produced pain over an extended period of time. Not a correct definition, by the way. That's pretty uniformly agreed. But that's the definition that these doctors were supposed to be applying.
And they came to the decision that this amounted to more than simply observation and had become experimentation because of the way that they would look at the information and then basically ratchet up the system.
That's exactly right, because the doctors were observing what was going on, drawing conclusions, and giving advice to the interrogators based on their observations. And that's the definition of experimentation. So they were saying, so many hours will work, or so many gallons of water for waterboarding will work. And so they were giving affirmative advice to the interrogators about how to torture, and the ability of these subjects to withstand the torture. Now, of course, let's back up and say, as a matter of medical ethics, this is, you know, beyond any discussion. This is clearly prohibited. Doctors are not supposed to do this. It's clearly totally unethical. And, of course, we have medical professionals, I think, for the ABA. The ABA has been completely clear about this. And what we had the intelligence agency attempt to do is to say, well, we're not really using MDs on this. We're really using psychologists. And the psychologists aren't viewing these individuals as their patients. They're giving tactical advice to the CIA, so they're not violating any ethical rules. And that's completely nonsensical, too. Although they got one of the professional organizations, the American Psychological Institution, which has long and very, very troublesome connections with the CIA, this institution seems to have bought into it to some extent and to have tried to have gutted its own ethics rules to provide some sort of cover. And it seems some very senior people from the APA, at least one we can identify right now, but probably several others, were involved in this torture program.
Now, this combined techniques idea, there's one aspect that I had spoken with Marcy Wheeler a few weeks about, which is that waterboarding has become sort of the shiny object, meaning it's really easy to throw that word around, and then what happens is you forget everything else that happened to the same person. You know that they've been waterboarded 89 times, but you don't think of the combination of things. When you take any one of these ideas by themselves, they're already violations, but when you start adding them up, you have something. For me, it's almost getting mentally unfathomable what they've done. Considering what we saw with the disbarment of people like you, what would happen to these medical professionals at this point?
Well, you know, to me, it's absolutely amazing that there haven't been efforts brought to strike their licenses, to de-license them. I mean, clearly there should be, because they've gone way beyond the limits of what the rules of ethics permit, and they've engaged in conduct that's the classic sort of conduct that would result in someone's forfeiture of a professional license. I expect that to happen. I expect, as more information comes out, I expect more such proceedings to be brought. And I'd say the reason that they haven't been kicked out of their professional organizations is very largely the United States government. The United States government is lying on their behalf, is covering up their conduct, is refusing cooperation with licensing organs that review these matters. It won't provide any information, and is refusing even to identify who these healthcare professionals are. So so we know that there were these healthcare professionals. They were present. They were engaged in running these experimentation operations. The government refuses to say a word about anything. In fact, what we're getting from the CIA after this report that was issued was just blanket denial. It's all untrue. And, of course, we know the CIA is absolutely authorized to lie about covert, highly classified operations, which, of course, is exactly what's going on here. Their denials are simply a lie because we have too much evidence already exposed to establish that, you know, what PHR is writing about absolutely happened, no doubt about it.
Right.
So, you know, I expect that we're going to see, in fact, I think, I'll take a guess. Mm-hmm. I think before this summer is over, we're going to see major efforts brought to yank the licenses of the key individuals who are running the human experimentation project. And I think the arguments that are going to be made are they engaged in unlawful conduct, they engaged in unethical conduct, and what they did was beyond the bounds of their professional expertise. And just to come back to the example you were just citing, one thing we know from this story is that these medical professionals gave advice to the CIA that you could use a large number of torture techniques in combination at the same time, because they concluded that the human body's ability to absorb pain is limited. It's only a certain amount that you can absorb. So if you're already doing one thing, you can do four or five other things at the same time, and it's not going to produce more pain, even though clearly it produces more psychological trauma. Mm-hmm. And the problem with that is it's junk science, to put it bluntly. It's wrong. And the people who were giving this advice had no professional qualifications to give that kind of advice. They didn't have the proper medical training or experience. And the advice that they gave is directly contradicted by the existing medical literature, which says just exactly the opposite. Moreover, if we go back to the prosecutions that occurred at the end of World War II, this is the same type of advice that was being given by German doctors who were engaged in human experimentation and was found to be criminal then. So it's pretty outrageous conduct. Now, another very important thing here vis-a-vis the Obama administration, you can go back and look at memoranda that the Obama administration has filed in the civil lawsuit surrounding John Yoo, in which they're supporting John Yoo, by the way.
Right.
They say in their memoranda that they don't think there should be civil liability for Mr. Yoo because he's protected, even though, of course, they acknowledge that the legal advice he gave was incompetent and wrong, and that people probably died as a result of the advice he gave. They say, nevertheless, under specific statutes, he's shielded from this liability. But then they go on to say that rule provides no protection whatsoever for Mr. Yoo against possible disbarment or being kicked out of his duties at the University of California. That's what the Department of Justice says. In other words, these people, you can't sue them, and we won't prosecute them because we have the discretion to prosecute and not prosecute whomever we want. And by the way, that's also a false argument because the Constitution obligates them to enforce the law, which they're not doing.
Right.
But these people can be disbarred or have their licenses stripped. That's the position the Justice Department has taken. So, you know, I think, frankly, that these efforts at disbarment and striking licenses are likely to succeed over time. But it'll be a question of a lot of politics, too, because there's certain jurisdictions in the United States where professional attitudes are very, very conservative, and they basically don't take away doctors' licenses, even when the crimes are egregious, almost never. Alabama, Louisiana, for instance, fall into that category. But I think we're going to find some jurisdictions that will act. And in New York State, we have our legislature on the verge now of adopting legislation that will, you know, bolster the basis for forfeiture of licenses in these cases.
That was one of the recommendations by the panel in its 10-point recommendations, was to go to every state and get legislation to cover this because of New York's statutes.
Yeah, the New York statute has very broad support right now, and most medical professional organizations have looked at it and have said, yeah, of course, the principles it articulates are correct.
According to the jurisdiction of this matter, we have already heard what David Margolis will say about the OLC memos. Would that be the same authority that would seek any prosecution? And so thus, at this point, only the disbarment from the medical associations will be what we may see from these?
David Margolis is not an expert in legal ethics. Absolutely not. No one thinks he is. In fact, his views about legal ethics are absurd. If you look at his report, he misconstrues them. He is not a member of a bar oversight authority or anything of the kind. He is an inside lawyer at the Department of Justice who never met an ethics complaint against a political official of the Department of Justice that he agreed with, ever. That's his history. The question, even with respect to the lawyers, is what will the state bar association say? Those are the ethics oversight officials. And on that, the question's still out. I don't know what's going to happen. You know, I think the Pennsylvania bar is going to look at John Yoo. I think the Nevada bar will wind up looking at Jay Bybee. I think the D.C. bar will probably look at both of them. But I don't know what's going to happen. But generally, bar associations act like a medieval guild. That is, they almost never kick out or even discipline their members. Almost never.
So what remedy would we see, though, constitutionally at this point, then? What possibility, at least internally, what would we have available?
Well, I think we're going to, you know, we will see, I think with the medical profession, you know, whether or not these medical professional organizations and license boards treat their ethics rules as something serious or not. And because I think so far there's no evidence that they view their ethics requirements as anything serious. And if they don't, then it's up to the public to call them out for what they've done. And I think it's also up to the public to, you know, take cognizance of these torture doctors. I mean, you know, would you want your mother to go get medical treatment at the hands of someone who committed torture or who was implicated directly in human experimentation of this sort? Well, I think, you know, consumers in our marketplace have a right to know who are treating them and what these people's background is. So that's a very fundamental point as well. And I think, you know, this information, you know, the CIA is working feverishly to keep the identities of all these people secret. But I can tell you these identities are all coming out now. In fact, they're coming out in large part because other people who worked with these people, these medical professionals, are completely appalled at what they did and are disclosing their identities.
I would make the argument to anyone that still works in the CIA, I've already said this to people who are former CIA agents, that if the CIA wants to retain its secrets, it better clean up the act, because every bad act forces a magnifying glass and a light on the institution itself. I'm learning more and more every day. For instance, I never really thought of their medical offices. You know, I would have never thought about that part of their operation. And yet that office is fully written about it. Not really fully, but I mean, it's quite in the middle of this report.
I think that's right. And you know, the lesson is pretty simple. That is, you know, you want to retain secrets, don't commit crimes.
Right.
You know, you cannot use state secrecy to keep crimes secret. That's improper. It's a completely illegitimate use of the state secrecy exception. Yet the CIA has been doing exactly that and has been doing it very, very heavily. And I think, what do? They delegitimize national security classifications when they do this. So right now, national security classifications are being used very aggressively to protect people who committed serious crimes from exposure of their criminal activities, prosecution, and possible forfeiture or revocation of their licenses. It won't work. The information will come out. And they delegitimize the national security claims by doing this.
You're listening to Veracity Radio. We're talking with Scott Horton. The this goes into a little bit about some of the cases I know you were looking at in Germany. What about international pressure, and will we expect any international response towards U.S. war crimes in the next year or so? And or what actions are currently in progress?
Well, there are a number of proceedings going on right now that involve some of these covert actions by the CIA, specifically that involve the black site operations, which are really the major focus of the Physicians for Human Rights report. The black sites were not, of course, they were not in the United States, were in other countries. Where the black sites were, let's say the conduct that was going on there, the human experimentation, the waterboarding, and so forth, clearly was a violation of criminal law of the jurisdictions where these things occurred. And there are going to be criminal investigations in many of these countries. I mean, for instance, it's very clear that the CIA maintained a black site in Poland. There is a criminal investigation going on in Poland right now into the activities that occurred at the black site. Equally clear that there was one, perhaps two, black sites that were maintained in Lithuania. Lithuanian prosecutors are also in the middle of a criminal investigation looking into what happened there. And other European states, in Italy, for instance, Italy, of course, being a NATO ally of the United States that supported the U.S. war in Iraq, sending its own soldiers, that's engaged in supporting military activities in Afghanistan today. But Italian prosecutors brought suit and secured the conviction of 23 CIA agents because of their operation that led to the kidnapping of an Egyptian cleric off the streets of Milan. He was then taken to Egypt, where he was turned over to national security officials and was tortured for a period of many, many months. And the convictions are for kidnapping, assault, and conspiracy to torture. And I think there may be further criminal actions brought in Italy based on those matters, because they have been, the Italian officials have been trying to establish the involvement of senior people in the CIA, including Stephen Kappas, in that activity. And I think they're close to developing the evidence to prove Kappas's direct involvement. So I think he might also be prosecuted next. In Spain, we have two criminal investigations going on, also into the black site operations. There's a criminal investigation that's just been opened in the UK. There's another one ongoing in Germany. And, each of these may result in the prosecution of American officials who were involved. And there's no doubt in my mind but that, the medical experimentation aspect is going to be viewed as an extremely serious crime that the prosecutors would not avoid acting on. In fact, we've had quite a bit of action in this area previously. In Chile, for instance, last year, a prosecution has been opened against medical personnel who were involved in working for the Pinochet regime and who used their profession basically to assassinate opposition political leaders, including the former head of the Christian Democratic Party, Eduardo Frei. His death following surgery has now been determined to have been an assassination carried out by doctors acting in coordination with and under the instructions of the Pinochet government. Another case of medical experimentation, but actually being charged in this case as murder.
Now, did we not have a U.S. judge not too long ago say that Rumsfeld could face civil lawsuits for detention and torture?
Well, John Ashcroft, but by theory, it would apply to Rumsfeld as well, yes.
So what was that decision, or which court?
That was a decision from a district court in California. Mm-hmm. It's a standout, I have to say. By and large, the great majority of the court cases have run in the opposite direction, concluding that the Westfall Act and other doctrines of immunity bar such suits against government officials. And by the way, the United States law in this sense has shifted quite dramatically over the last 20 years as our federal judiciary has come to be overwhelmingly populated by conservative Republican judges. this is one doctrine that was concocted out of whole cloth, this notion of immunity of government officials. Prior U.S. law was very, very clear that there was no immunity of government officials for the crime of torture in specific. In fact, the U.S. trumpeted that view at the end of World War II, and that underlay our prosecutions at Nuremberg. No immunity of government officials for torture. And now we see all these federal judges in every single case, a conservative Republican appointee, suddenly saying there's complete immunity for these people. There's no accountability, contrary to prior U.S. doctrine and law. So this is an area where I think some modification of American legal doctrine is far, far past due.
What is the legal obligation, international legal obligation, over the Obama administration regarding its war crimes prosecutions?
Well, let's just start with the notion of torture. The U.S. is subscribed the Convention Against Torture. I mean, not only did the U.S. subscribe the Convention Against Torture, the U.S. essentially wrote the Convention Against Torture. And under that document, when credible allegations of torture are presented, there is an absolute obligation that cannot be waived to initiate a criminal investigation. Now, in this case, with the Obama administration, we have a very substantial number of more than credible allegations. I mean, we have cases where judges have found in other contexts that there was torture. And yet there is no criminal investigation that has been commenced. And we're told that the decision not to initiate a criminal investigation has been taken on a political basis. That is, Barack Obama's decision not to look back, to look forward, not to look backwards. But of course, Barack Obama, well, let's just start with the fact that the only thing prosecutors do is look backwards. By definition, unless you believe in science fiction, by definition, every crime occurs in the past.
In fact, the whole war on terror would have to stop right now.
Of course. And so, I mean, next time you're pulled over for speeding by a cop, you might just turn to him and say, "But officer, remember, President Obama says don't look back." You know, well, that's just completely absurd. I mean, it really has no intellectual credibility. But moreover, the President of the United States, the Attorney General, they have sworn a solemn oath to uphold and enforce the law. And that oath was not just to uphold and enforce the law except when it's politically inconvenient to do so. So clearly this is an area where criminal investigation should have been launched. That's the requirement of the Constitution. That's the requirement of American law. That's the requirement of international law and the Convention Against Torture in particular. It's also the requirement of the Geneva Conventions. And the United States is not living up to those requirements. And whereas the breaches may have occurred in the Bush administration, the failure to follow through on the obligation to investigate is occurring in the Obama administration.
Would it be accurate to say I've had people who like to call me and keep up with the potential prosecution of Mr. Cheney and Rumsfeld and crew? Would it be accurate to say there are very few actions still percolating around? One would be, for instance, the CIA tapes. Is that a fairly accurate assessment that there's not much activity on any of these topics now?
Yeah, I would say that the main thing that's going on right now is John Durham, who was appointed as a special prosecutor, who was appointed in the Bush administration as a special prosecutor, not in the Obama administration. John Durham is a career prosecutor from Connecticut, a registered Republican with some history of activity in Republican politics, of course. And he was assigned the role of investigating the disappearance of the 92 CIA tapes, many of which we believe may be connected to the human experimentation program. And that, you know, that appointment's been out there for more than 2 years now. There's no evidence of any activity. And then Eric Holder expanded his mandate a little bit to pick up cases in which the CIA Inspector General recommended there be a criminal investigation. So he's given those cases as well. And by the way, these two cases are very closely connected. because I think the tapes are going to be shown to record activities, you know, that are associated with the Inspector General's report. So what we really saw was destruction of evidence that could be used in prosecution.
And this would be with John Rodriguez, who authorized Jose Rodriguez, who authorized the program and then basically apparently unanimously just simply decided to destroy them. Is that?
Well, that was the explanation that's been floated. But, you know, my understanding is that that Durham's investigation has now come across and established pretty convincing evidence that Porter Goss, the director of the CIA, understood and approved the decision to destroy these tapes. And I think we may very well eventually find that that decision had strong support in the White House. But, you know, that's, of course, a focus of the current investigation.
Before I ask about drone strikes, what do you think citizens, average citizens, can do or participate in order to guarantee accountability for the former top administration officials like Cheney and or George W. Bush?
Well, I think it's very important for them to be in touch with their congressmen and say that they're troubled by this and they believe that there should be an investigation and there should be accountability. I think the first thing that needs to happen is the investigation. And, of course, that can't happen out. It doesn't have to be in the context of a prosecution with a professional prosecutor. It can happen as a result of having a commission of inquiry appointed as well, along the lines that Patrick Leahy, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, requested. I think, you know, if there's a more vocal expression of support for this sort of inquiry, that would be very useful. I think we're entitled to know the facts. That's the first thing.
Let's move to this drone strike. The CIA is not a part of the military in such a way that it carries rank, like someone who works in the other armed services. How does that affect the discussion on the legality of the CIA drone strikes, meaning that the CIA are the actual operators of these drones? They're the ones making the decisions, but they don't have – they're not within the strata. Am I misreading how that works?
No, you're right. It's an absolutely critical fact. Well, let's just take a bit of a history excursion here.
Okay.
You go back and you remember all those movies from World War II and about World War II.
Name, rank, and serial number.
Intelligence. Well, that's the Geneva thing.
Yeah.
But remember, you've got military intelligence officers, and we had Wild Bill Donovan, and we had the OSS, you know, but the OSS was an adjunct to the military, and OSS figures were uniformed military officers. So it was a part of our military apparatus. At the end of World War II, Congress and the administration took a long look at this and tried to figure out what's the right way to organize this, given that we're coming into a Cold War period, we're going to have a big intelligence operation, but there's not really an active war going on of any sort. And a decision was made, the National Security Act of 1947, that laid the foundations for the current CIA, and it said this is going to be a civilian agency. Its mandate is going to be intelligence gathering. Its employees are not going to be uniformed military personnel, and they're not going to necessarily be trained according to the Geneva Conventions and laws of war because its activities largely are not going to go on in warfare and in connection with war. And by contrast, the real defense operation is going to be in the hands of the Department of Defense. And the Department of Defense will control our major weapons system and will have the right to use lethal force in hostilities. Now, that's not to say the CIA had no right to use lethal force. For instance, of course, it could use lethal force for self-defense and in connection with very specific, limited, covert operations. But, you know, broadly speaking, the defense function was in the Department of Defense. Now, what's happened, let's just jump forward, you know, some 60 years, and we see what's happened is that the CIA is moving steadily away from the original concept that was laid down. It's developing a paramilitary apparatus, and it is assuming more and more of a direct role in military and war activities. And the strongest manifestation we see of this so far has to do with drones. So drones, I'd say robotics generally, are the cutting edge, state-of-the-art technology for warfare. And the Predator drone, there are many different kinds of robotic weaponry. The one that's really well known right now is the Predator drone. And in fact, we see this drone war going on in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border area. And a very substantial part of that war is being controlled and driven by the CIA. So this is the first time in American history that the CIA controls a state-of-the-art, cutting-edge new weapons technology. Historically, these things had always been controlled by the military. And why is that a big deal? Because the military is trained to and has procedures to apply the laws of war. They have a firm grasp of the legal requirements that underlie targeting and use of these weapons. They understand the proportionality calculus that goes on. They're all up and ready to do this. The CIA is not. And if we look at the law of armed conflict, it says that in wartime, uniformed military personnel have a privilege to use lethal force in the right circumstances. They pull a trigger, fire a bullet, kill someone. That is not homicide under the criminal law because it's specifically privileged. But guess what? The CIA does not have that privilege. And therefore, when the CIA uses this weaponry, it's still subject to potentially being prosecuted under the criminal law. It's not exempted from it. And you want to see a clear example of how that plays out. You can look at the prosecution that's going on today by the United States in the military commissions in Guantanamo of a child named Omar Khadr, who, when 15 years of age in Afghanistan, is accused of having lobbed a grenade that killed an American and wounded several others. He denies he lobbed the grenade. Actually, the evidence case against him is pretty weak, is extremely weak, I'd say, at this point. But in any event, he was arrested, has been held in difficult conditions for 8 years now, he's being charged with homicide because he used lethal force in violation of the laws of war. And most law of war experts disagree with that whole analysis. They say it's incorrect. But in any event, if the U.S. is right about that, well, then the same sort of crime and the same sort of charges could be brought against a CIA employee who's engaged in drone warfare.
Or private contractors.
Or a private contractor, exactly.
There's one question that kind of boggled the discussion this week, which is we still do not understand, those of us who talk too much about these cases probably, but why were Bruce Jessen and James Mitchell and why? Because you brought in like the fact that the military has expertise. And the thing that popped in my brain was that the FBI has the best interrogators in the business. Next to that would be people like Steve Kleinman, who are professional interrogators. But these guys were not the ones being used.
I think that there's pretty strong evidence right now that Mitchell and Jessen are professionally grossly incompetent. They have no expertise in the area where they were working. And why did the military use them? I'll just put it this way. They wanted yes men. They wanted to find medical professionals who would give them a green light. I'd say they are the substantive equivalent of John Yoo. You know, John Yoo has a law degree and will give you whatever opinion you want as long as you appoint him to a high political office. And Mitchell and Jessen, you pay them their retainer and you treat them well, and they'll give you an okay for anything.
Right.
That's the reason they were being used.
I forget what the title of one of their thesis was, but there's nothing in their background that even applies to the expertise of information.
That's right. No expertise in this area. No learned work in this area. And it's quite clear that the advice they were giving was objectively incorrect, was what I would call junk or pseudoscience. But they were brought in because they would give the answer that the Department of Defense wants. And I think maybe the much more interesting question is Marty Seligman. There is a growing case suggesting Seligman is in the background here, that he's involved, that he knew about the experimentation project, for instance, and his involvement appears to have been to legitimize what Jessen and Mitchell were doing.
Scott Horton, you have a great blog. It's No Comment at Harper's. I also want to let the audience know that you write really interesting articles on art, and I appreciate that. It actually changes the hard torture discussion that we're always involved in and the human rights issues that plague us. And I want to thank you for joining us on Veracity Radio and hope you'll come back and we can talk about a few specific cases of detainees and look a little bit closer at the war on terror's legal realm. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you.